Hi again, everybody. Thanks for joining our conversation today with James Sutphin, Jimmy Sutphin. His father built the Cleveland Arena. We're talking to Jimmy. He's 82 years old now, and this is October 1st, 2014. This is his dad, a book written about the man in the arena, Al Sutphin and the Cleveland Arena, written by George Condon. Several copies of this book are here in the Cleveland Public Library. So, Jim, you grew up in the arena. You saw everything there. What was your favorite events?
Certainly ice hockey.
Yeah.
But it was so wonderful to have so many things going on. And my dad, of course, was, and my mother were usually at the arena early. Uh-huh. But my grandparents, my father's mother and dad, religiously picked me up at home.
Really?
And took me down to the arena. Uh-huh. Now, I would take my school books with me, of course, uh-huh, and study between the periods. But I saw a lot of hockey, and Dad was into college basketball, just a wide variety of sports.
Jim, this was an era in America where all the arenas were privately owned. Nobody thought of the taxpayers building an arena. And as a matter of fact, the first taxpayer-funded venue might have been the Cleveland Stadium. Because even the ballparks back then were privately owned. Remember the names of them: Briggs Stadium, Comiskey Park, Fenway Park, all privately owned. The same with the arenas, and that's why much of sports in that era was driven by the private ownership of these arenas. For example, the American Hockey League, formed by what? Arena owners.
Arena owners.
Because you needed dates. The ice shows. Sonya Henie had an ice show. Tell me that story. That led to the ice capades and the ice follies because of her.
It led to the ice capades.
Okay.
The arena opened in November of 37.
Tell the story about how your father had this idea.
Well, I think it's kind of a two-part story.
Okay.
The first part is 1934. Yes. When I'm 2 years old, uh-huh, I have four older sisters.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty much the middle of the Depression.
Uh-huh.
As the stock market went in the dumper in 1928. Anyway, my dad comes home and says, "Mary, I got a really good idea." And she says, "What's that?" He says, "I'm going to buy a hockey team." And my mother apparently says, "Why are you buying a hockey team?" He says, "It's a really good deal. They're broke."
And they were playing at the Elysium.
Oh, they were playing at the Elysium.
That was where?
107th in Euclid.
Okay.
It was owned by the same people that own Euclid Beach, the Humphreys.
Oh.
And it had 2,000 seats.
Oh.
It was kind of a neat place to see a game. They had a small balcony that went around. But then became very popular, and they packed the place. So then in the very early part of 1937, my dad comes home and says to my mother, "Mary, I'm going to build an arena." And why is that? He says, "Well, we need more seats." So in November of 37, the Cleveland Arena opened. And
seating how many?
9,950.
Why not 10,000?
They would have put them in a different tax bracket.
For property taxes?
Property taxes.
Were based on the seating capacity?
Yes.
Wow.
Imagine that.
So, yes. And so I can remember growing up here, as you, that place was packed so often. Hockey, of course, was the big draw.
Yeah, Saturday night at the Cleveland Arena, amazing how things also change. It was camel hair coats. All the women were dressed up.
Oh.
It was the place to be on a Saturday night, was at the arena.
The arena had a smell, the popcorn, the hot dogs. Every building like that has a smell, yes. Now, do you remember, there were fights and boxing, and but there was one of the most remarkable stories of that arena was the NBA, actually the Basketball Association of America, or whatever it was called, was founded in 1946. Once again, the NBA founded by the arena owners, right?
Correct.
And so I, There were like 11 teams that first year, including Cleveland. We had the Cleveland Rebels.
We did.
We were one of the original franchises in the NBA.
Correct.
Lasted 1 year. Tell us what, pick up that story, Jim.
Well, I don't mean to pick on the sports writers.
But, hey, I know. I'll add to that story.
Where the sports writers in Cleveland really supported hockey, and we were packing them in, just not 9,950, but usually 11,000 people on a Saturday night. But for some reason, the sports writers were not that crazy about pro basketball, and they didn't cover it very well, and there was no TV, and there was no radio, so you solely depended upon income by people who came through the turnstile. Yes. And people were just not coming through the turnstile. So after just 1 year in the American Basketball Association, my dad had a fold because it was, you know, he just couldn't afford to have a loser like that.
He wasn't the only one. About three or four teams folded after that first year. And he didn't, he folded, he didn't sell it, didn't move it. Guess that wasn't done back in those days.
Just, that was it.
Now, Hal Levitz told me when he was the sports editor of the Plain Dealer, he was a witness to that, what happened in 1946. And among the sports writers, Whitey Lewis from the Cleveland Press, openly hostile, disinterested. But Hal was a big basketball fan. And so he remembered that, how the newspapers killed the Cleveland Rebels. And so in 1967, when a brand new soccer league started, and Gabe Paul and Vernon Stover, who owned the Indians, they bought a franchise in this new soccer league, big-time soccer. And Hal said, called me in one day, and he said, we don't want them to ever be able to say that we're the reason, the Plain Dealer is the reason they went out of business. So he said, we're going to cover them like a major league team. And you're our soccer writer. I don't know anything about soccer. He sent me to England to learn the game with the Stoke City team. And then he said, find an auto race to cover too. So I did, in Monte Carlo the next week. So anyway, that's why I say soccer was very, very good to me. But of course, at that time, and basketball could have been very, very good to us if the papers had just given them a chance.
Well, as the miracle at Richfield proved,
yes.
If you build it, they will come.
Yes. And once again, by the way, while we're talking about these buildings that are privately financed, the Richfield Coliseum might have been the last one that was privately built. Everything else now is built with tax dollars. So anyway, your father, he had to have some means, even though that was the Depression, he had to have some means to get into this business in the first place. Your father was president of Braden Sutphin Ink Company.
Correct.
They sold ink to what, newspapers?
Mostly commercial printers. Some newspapers, but mostly commercial printers.
And it was a pretty good business.
Very good business. And it's still around.
Yeah, it is.
The company is 100 years old.
Wow.
Started in 1913, and last October of 2013, we had a wonderful celebration of the West Reserve Historical Society. Uh-huh. And in that 100 years, we've only had five presidents, and currently my nephew, Jim Leach, is the president, which is keeping it in the family.
There was your dad, your brother.
Mr. Braden.
Oh, Mr. Braden, that's right.
Mr. Braden and my dad and myself and my brother.
Wow. When the arena was built, like the ink company was like right next door, wasn't it?
Well, behind it on Chester.
Okay.
The arena was built on Euclid Avenue.
Yes.
Like, 3800 Euclid Avenue.
Uh-huh.
And the, and the arena on Euclid, the ink company on Chester. Mm-hmm. And part of the way to finance the new arena was to have a lease from the ink company to the arena for 20 years.
Wow. Okay. Your father had trouble financing the building of the arena. That was in the Depression.
Banks
weren't lending any money. Maybe they didn't have any money to lend. I don't know. Would you tell us that story, how that thing developed?
Well, it was kind of interesting. Most of the arenas in America had gone broke. So they were not, banks were not very interested in financing an arena.
Thank you.
Can we do
this?
Yeah,
absolutely, we can.
I can't believe I got a raspy throat, but I do.
Did I give you mine already? I think that our viewers and listeners will, they can deal with this. That's okay.
Okay, I think I'm ready. So there was my dad. Was very good friends with Ray Miller, who was the mayor in Cleveland at the time. And he also knew a gentleman by the name of Judge Frank Merrick.
Chief of probate court. Everybody knew Frank back then. Yes.
Well, how Frank knew Charlie Sawyer in Cincinnati, I'm not quite sure how that happened. But anyway,
Charlie Sawyer was with an insurance company, wasn't he?
Union Central Life Insurance. So Judge Merrick says to my dad, Albert, you take your flip chart, you go down to see Mr. Sawyer at Union Central Life Insurance, you go through your presentation, I bet you he'll loan you the money. And he did.
Gee. And then, ironically,
in 1968, the same Charlie Sawyer helped Paul Brown get back into football with the Bengals.
And wasn't that your father telling Paul Brown, call Charlie Sawyer?
Paul, go see Charlie Sawyer. He'll probably help you out like he did me.
Oh, gee. So many events at the Cleveland Arena. Boxing was big. Big-time fights all the time. In fact, one of the most tragic nights in boxing was when Sugar Ray Robinson killed Jimmy Doyle in the ring, 1947. And the day of the fight, Whitey Lewis wrote in his column in the Cleveland Press, they better have the ambulances ready tonight for Jimmy Doyle. Wow. Whitey wasn't that prescient. That was an expression, you know, have the ambulances ready because Jimmy Doyle doesn't have a chance against Sugar Ray. So, but anyway, the big time fights all the time in the arena. And even in its final days, after your family was out of it, Don Elbaum came in and promoted a lot of fights, which I covered. And anyway, we had Ali boxed an exhibition at the arena. We had George Foreman and Ken Norton fight, not against each other, but before they got famous, but they fought at the arena. So many, and we had champions, world champions, in and out of the arena all the time. Were you interested in the boxing much?
Not really.
No.
I wrestled in high school, so I...
Did you? was that at Cathedral Latin or University School or where?
I went to University School. Graduated in 1950.
Okay.
Then I stayed home, went to John Carroll.
Uh-huh.
I always like to tell our kids, I said, when I went to John Carroll, I lived at home.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know I wasn't supposed to like it.
There were other events such as 6-day bike races.
Yes.
What the heck were they?
Well, it was 24 hours a day, for sure.
They raced 24 hours a day?
24 hours a day.
Nonstop for 6 days?
6 days.
People went and they liked it?
One bike would be on there, and his teammate would come up and they'd touch, and then that guy'd get off, and the other guy'd keep going.
And the fans sat there for hours on end?
Some stayed overnight.
You're kidding. Wow. Well, that they had a wooden banked track.
Yes.
Was it built just for the arena, or was it one that they could adjust to move it around to
they
various
could move
other
it around.
Arenas, did they?
They would move it around. But it was noisy.
Really?
And then, of course, we also had the Knights of Columbus track meet.
Oh, of course, yes.
And that was pretty popular.
Yes.
And Boy Scouts would also have their jamborees.
Really?
As I've mentioned to people over the years, there's 365 days in the year.
Yes.
There's only 35 home hockey games. So that means there are 330 nights where the building could be dark.
You couldn't have that.
You can't have that. So the idea was to have something going on all the time.
Wow. High school basketball, we always have the city championship game there. That was always a big event.
Yes.
The East and West Senate champions playing for the city title. We even had the one year, we had the state wrestling tournament at the Cleveland Arena. You may not remember that because you weren't involved in high school sports back then, but by that time. But yeah, you hosted the at the arena, the state wrestling championships. Also, another year, we had the state basketball finals. That was when they were building St. John's Arena in Columbus. It wasn't done, so they moved it up here for 1 year. Middletown played here. Wrestling, pro wrestling was big at the arena. It was there were people who took that seriously, thought it was real.
My dad, when he heard I was going to be a wrestler,
really?
He was not happy.
Oh.
Because all he could think about was, it's fixed.
Yes.
But I also like to tell you a story about the program. The Cleveland Arena program for hockey games was 8.5 by 11 at 96 pages.
Really? Wow.
And the kind of the fun thing around the league was, if you're playing in Cleveland, be sure you don't get hit by a program. Fan is going to try to hit a referee.
Oh, gee.
The referee had made a bad decision. Boy, in Cleveland, don't get hit by the program.
Boy, that was chock full of advertising, wasn't it? Yeah.
And again, you know, like the red tie and the blue suit, my dad sold mostly ads in the program.
Did he?
Called on all the companies in town.
He did.
He sold the tickets, the season tickets, and the ads in the program.
He was pretty busy. Then he was trying to run an ink company as well?
Yes.
Now, he sold the arena in 1949. How did that come about?
Well, I guess you might say he finally didn't owe anybody any money. When he bought the company from Mr. Braden in 1929.
That's the ink company.
The ink company. He agreed to pay him over 20 years, 29 to 49. And the mortgage on the arena was going to end up in 1949. So for the first time in his life, he didn't owe anybody any money. They paid off the mortgage, he paid off to Mr. Braden, and I think he thought, this is time to, and he was 55 years old, I think it's time to wind down a little bit. Now he did want to keep the team, he loved the hockey game, but he wanted to kind of get out of the arena business and all the negotiations for ice shows and arenas and wrestling and so forth. But the new owners, two of them were from the Ice Follies, Shipson and Johnson, said, no, we want the hockey team too. So kind of reluctantly, our dad said, okay, I'll sell the arena and the hockey team.
Well, the Barons won the Calder Cup in 1948. They went on to win more Calder Cups through the 50s and 60s. But the last one they won for your father was 1948. That was the year that the Cleveland was called, dubbed itself, the City of Champions.
City of Champions.
We had the Barons, the champions of the American Hockey League. The Indians won the pennant. The Browns won the
All-American Football Conference.
That's right. So, tell me about the rings.
That was kind of
your dad was so sure they were going to win.
Kind of nifty.
Yes.
As the season was winding down, Cleveland had actually gone 30 some games without a loss.
Wow.
There's a couple ties in there. They didn't play overtimes in the regular season, but they'd gone 30 games without a loss, and now they're in the playoffs.
Wow.
And my father was so positive that they were going to win the Calder Cup that he bought the rings ahead of time. And as the players came into the dressing room, having won the Calder Cup, he passed out the rings.
Wow.
I mean, what if they'd have lost?
Oh, gee.
He had a few rings left over.
Yeah. Well, they must have been enthralled.
They were.
The Barons had an opportunity to go into the National Hockey League. Would you tell me that story?
Sure. That's a story that hardly anybody believes, but it's the truth. Our dad has worked very hard to make the American League what it was. You know, the National League had six teams. We had 12.
So and your dad was instrumental in forming the American Hockey League?
Yes.
And keeping it going?
And building it.
Really?
You know, Hershey Bears, Springfield Indians, Providence Reds.
Sure. Syracuse Nationals. Capitals. Yeah, oh, sure. Went down the list.
And
Syracuse, so, Rochester, Buffalo. Yeah.
Pittsburgh Hornets.
That's right. Indianapolis was in the league for a
yes,
while.
Yes, they were. So my dad had worked very hard to make the American League pretty solid, you know, league. And just as about 1948-49, because we are the city of champs, the National League offered our dad a chance to be merged in to the National Hockey League. My father, being a man of great integrity, says, I can't do that. I will not basically...
He would not abandon his
I would
old
not abandon
partners?
My friends.
Really?
I will not abandon my friends. Wow. They would think very badly of me if I would take this wonderful opportunity and leave them kind of holding the bag, so to speak.
And he could get in without essentially paying an admission fee, which
exactly.
would be a franchise fee today of millions upon millions of dollars.
Definitely.
They wanted Cleveland in the league.
They wanted Cleveland in the league. I guess New York was a sunny night town. Chicago was a sunny night town, and Cleveland played on Saturday night, so it seemed like the perfect arrangement to have a team halfway between New York and Chicago that played on Saturday night. But he didn't do it.
Gee. Many years later, we did get into the National Hockey League. It started and stopped, and it was later on the Barons and their successive teams. Their successor teams became stop and start operations then, and we know what the situation is with hockey now. It's really not very pretty.
Yeah, the Barons made a comeback in the National Hockey League at the Coliseum in, you know, I think it was 1978. But unfortunately, even though the Coliseum, Mileti thought the perfect place was be halfway between Akron and Cleveland.
Yes.
It wasn't. And the attendance just wasn't very good.
That's right. It wasn't close to anybody, either Akron or Cleveland. And the site of the old Coliseum is now a barren field.
It sure is. We're having dinner at the Fishers in Peninsula.
Oh, yeah.
The guy walks by. Then he walks by again, and he kind of looks at us, and he says, where's the Coliseum? And I said, well, why? And he said, well, I live in Denver, but my parents were there in October 1974 when it opened, and they said, when you're in Northeast Ohio, go to the Coliseum. It's kind of a neat building. There's probably something going on.
Uh-huh.
And he said, I've been all the way to Peninsula. I've been all the way to Hudson, but I can't find it. We said, well, would you believe in 1999 they tore it down?
Wow. Gee.
And you're right, Dan. It is, you would never know it was there. It is just a field.
Yes. So the Coliseum may be a story for another day here at the library, but might have been the last privately financed building of its kind. And now everything is built by taxpayers. Thank God for taxpayers, huh?
The syntax.
Yes, yes. What else do should we, I know. We skipped over this very early in our conversation, and that was Sonya Henney the Ice Capades and all that. Would you tell that story?
Well, it was very important to the arena owners to have two ice shows, one in the fall and one in the spring. And the Ice Follies were very solid, and they came in the spring, not spring, actually, January and February. And Sonny Henney came in the fall. Uh-huh. But she was not only quite an excellent figure skater, but she was a tough business lady and kind of irritated all the arena owners. So much so that apparently at one of the arena managers' meetings, they said, why don't we start our own show? So they did. John Harris from Pittsburgh was a theatrical guy, so he was kind of the nucleus for putting together the Ice Capades.
Ice Capades. Now, Sonia Henie's show was the Ice Follies, huh?
No, no, no.
Oh.
She was, so it was her own show.
Oh.
It was called,
Sonia Henie on Ice or something?
Probably.
Something like that.
Based in Chicago. Art Wertz was the owner. But, yep. She came to Cleveland twice, the fall of 37 and the fall of 38, and that was it.
Really?
From then on, it was the Ice Capades.
But now you needed a show in the spring and one in the fall or the summer, whenever.
Right.
So one was, is that how one became the Follies and one became the Capades?
No, the Follies were always the Follies.
Oh, they were?
They were always the Follies. They started probably, they started in Minneapolis. Shipstead and Johnson were Minneapolis guys. They probably started their show 1934.
I see. So they were in competition with Sonia Henie. They were. So now you added another show. Did that pretty much force her out of business?
I don't think so.
No?
She's pretty much just focused on Chicago after that.
I see. What other indoor events were in there?
We had a wonderful program called the Aqua Parade. They had a big pool.
Really?
People like Esther Williams and so forth came there and swam, and they had divers. And we had big bands. We had Tommy Dorsey who would come to the arena for a one-nighter.
Really? And, of course, then there was the things such as the Golden Gloves.
Definitely.
That would be several days, six, three rings in the going simultaneously. Yeah, that was always a big event at the arena.
That was another one of those things you needed to fill up.
Fill up
the 300. That's why he got highly involved with John Carroll on the doubleheader basketball program in 47, 48, 49.
Ah, so they were college basketball doubleheaders, yes.
So it would be John Carroll playing somebody, and then he'd try to bring in Kentucky and some of the bigger names to draw people. And then for a short time, he worked with Father Welfley at John Carroll to help stimulate the John Carroll basketball program.
I see. There are so many millions of stories. Some of course, I can remember, as many of us do who grew up on the West Side back then, we would take the streetcars downtown, change at the square, take the bus down Euclid Avenue to the arena. Now, you mentioned 3800. I remember the address 3701 Euclid Avenue, but which was the address of the arenas from what I knew. But anyway, I don't mean to correct you. But kids, we were 10 years old. Didn't give it a thought. You guys, the kids, you're going to the hockey games? Yes, we were. Here's enough for a ticket and for popcorn and the bus.
Well, my dad used to take the entire St. Anne's Grammar School to the circus.
Really? Oh, there's another one.
And he went to see Father Powers at St. Anne's.
Uh-huh.
And Father Powers said, well, I don't know. They talked for a while. Dad was a pretty good salesman. Uh-huh. Finally, Father Powers, okay, he calls up the guy at CTS. He says, we want to take the entire school to the circus. And when the streetcar gets down to the bottom of Cedar Road Hill, there's a loop down there. And some of the streetcars would go down Cedar, and then they would get a transfer, you'd get on another streetcar and go down Euclid.
Uh-huh.
He says, we don't want the kids to get off the streetcar. So when they get to the bottom of Cedar Road Hill, that same streetcar is going to go down Euclid. You can take care of that, right? He says, yes, Father. So they did. I bump into kids today. They say, I remember going to the circus when your dad took the entire school.
I don't recall that there's a basement in the arena.
Not really.
I mean, where did you put, didn't you need a basket or something backstage to store these animals?
Well, there was big, long tunnels in all four corners of the building where That's where the dressing rooms were located. Big, all four corners had big, long tunnels that went outside. And then between the arena and the ink company, there was quite a bit of space. So that's where the elephants would be. And that was always kind of fun.
Yes. Do you know that it is said that elephants cannot, there's a limit to how steep a grade an elephant can walk. And that's when in the design of any arena like that, they have to, the ramps going up and down to various levels, they have to consider the limitations of elephants. Either that or you can't hold a circus in the building.
Now, I didn't know that.
Yes.
But I think one of the most amazing things our dad did to promote hockey that first year was giving away a Ford automobile.
Really?
There's like 30 home games.
Mm-hmm.
He gave away 30 Ford automobiles, one every home game.
Wow.
In 1937. And it was, and the number was in the lucky number program.
Uh-huh.
And they gave away other things from Fisher Foods and so forth.
Uh-huh.
But the last number called was the number for the car. They would drive the car down this ramp, out onto the ice. They read the number, the guy, I got it. He come down, get in the car, and drive away.
Oh, gee.
The Northern Ohio Ford dealers put in $300.
Really?
And the Cleveland Arena put in $300. A new car, 1937, cost $600.
Gee.
But wow, it really brought the people. Because the guy said, hey, I got to buy a program for a quarter. Sure. I might win a car.
Wow. That is really something. Well, I don't know. I know we can't be done. There must be many more tales. The rodeos. Yeah, the rodeos were there.
Sure.
I've got a story about a rodeo. This was one of the last events at the arena was a rodeo. And so one night, a couple guys from, I had a softball team, a Sunday morning softball team. My softball players were on the east side carousing one night. They're driving back through town, right down Euclid Avenue, middle of the summer. And the rodeo was there, and to promote the rodeo, they had this big plastic bull, size and a half of a bull. My softball players, one of them had a pickup truck, they stole the bull. It wasn't nailed down or anything. So that they stole it on a Friday night. Saturday, it's broadcast on all the radio stations. Somebody hijacked rustled the bull rustlers. And so these, my softball guys were living in a big house on Lake Avenue. And this was on the radio all day. So Sunday morning, I had to drive around and to several of my players, and like Sunday mornings, they weren't too healthy. And I had to get them, wake them up for the games, doubleheaders Sunday mornings. And I pull up to this one house where three or four of them lived, front window, picture window, wide open, and here's the bull right there in the picture window. Now, they had been, the radio and television had been having so much fun about this bull that now, they had borrowed the bull from Chester Meats, a meatpacking company out in Geauga County. As fate would have it, I was doing commercials for Chester Meats at the time, television commercials. This was a nice little sidelight I had going. They paid handsomely to do these. I would dress up in a butcher's outfit. So now, I don't want to be implicated in the theft of this bull, my softball team. So anyway, we wound up getting it back to them on Monday, but I never did a commercial for Chester Meats ever again. Anyway, there were the fun they would have, these TV anchors and all that, the fun they had about the missing bull, kidnapped the bull, held for ransom. Oh.
Well, now did this meatpacking company fire you?
No, I just never heard from them again. But we got the bull back to them. I would have think that they should have been grateful.
Well.
So rodeos, what would they last, about a week maybe?
About a week.
Yeah.
But I mean, circuses, just about everything you think of, as I say, aqua parades, one-nighters.
Yeah. Gee.
Lots of things going on.
Well, let me hold up again. All of these stories, most of them anyway, are in this book, The Man in the Arena, The Life and Times of A.C. Sutphen. And this is his son, Jim, who lived through that era.
I think the point I really want to make,
yes,
is that how many guys that you know could come home in 1934 and say to their wife, "Mary, I got a really good idea. I'm going to buy a hockey team." I'm pretty sure my wife would have said, "I don't think so." And most of our wives. Yes. So our mother was a saint. She yes. was. She supported our dad on everything he ever thought of, and he was involved in a lot of stuff. He was boxing commissioner.
Boxing commissioner.
In okay. Cleveland. And they also went to all these Olympics. You know, he went to oh. Summer Olympics in 24, 28, 32. He would have gone to Berlin, but he was in the process of trying to get this arena thing going. But he went to the Summer Olympics in 48, took my brother and I to Helsinki in 52. His last Olympics was 1960. And he had this procedure that my brother and I had to follow. If you're going to go to the Olympics like we did in 52, you start a notebook, 100 meter, 200 meter, 110 meter high hurdles. You had the dividers in there so that you knew who the athletes were, who the runners were. Because his argument was, Dan, that if you haven't done your homework, you're going to be looking down there and they're running the 10,000 meter race, which takes 28 minutes. It looks like a bunch of guys running around in their underwear. So if you've done your homework, you know who all these runners are. So 1996, Louise and I went to Atlanta for the Summer Olympics, mm-hmm. and I had not done my homework. So I'm sitting up in the stands, and they're running the 10,000 meter race. Uh-huh. These guys are running. I said, "Dad, you're right. Looks like a bunch of guys running around in their underwear."
Oh, gee. And of course, you came to the Winter Olympics in 1980 for old time's sake, I guess, but you didn't see any of the hockey games.
We did.
Oh,
we
did.
Saw the United States and Sweden.
Oh.
That first week.
Okay.
But we were not there for the famous game on yeah. Friday night.
Yes.
Against Russia.
Yes.
But I still think one of the great one-liners of all time was Mike Ruzzioni, the captain who scored the winning goal. Uh-huh. Tells everybody, "We weren't the best players, but we were the best team." Uh-huh. I like that. There's no I in team.
I covered those Olympics, and I can remember sitting there the night we beat the Russians, and I had an angle where I could see the Russian Olympic committee, the guys in their bearskin coats, and boy, I felt sorry for that coach when that was over. They did not look happy.
It's kind of interesting, too, Dan, is that you ask somebody at a cocktail party who won the gold medal. Who did the United States yeah. beat for the gold yes. medal in 1980?
Yes.
Most people will say Russia.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't Russia, because that was a semifinal. The United States had to come back on Sunday without having a letdown, and uh-huh. they beat Finland for the gold medal.
That's right. Well, Jim, this has been a pleasure recalling that era. It was really a unique era when the building managers had to make ends meet with no help from taxpayers or anybody. It's interesting to note one final note, and that is that the Cavaliers were very content playing out at the Richfield Coliseum. The Guns owned the team. They also owned the building, the way it had always been done in the old days. The only reason they weren't looking to move downtown, but Cleveland stole the Cavs from Richfield because they wanted that tax base and they wanted that attraction in downtown Cleveland. They stole the Cavs from the city of Richfield by giving them an arena in downtown Cleveland.
Right.
They did that a year before Baltimore stole the Browns. So I have to keep reminding people, we did it first, and we stole from our very neighbors in Summit County.
That nice.
So anyway, I always, that is a burden I carry. I have to get it off my chest all the time. we can't skate free on that deal. So Jim Sutphin, boy, you've got marvelous memories, boy.
Well, Dan, I appreciate the opportunity to share those memories.
Here you went into the Cleveland Sports Stars Hall of Fame. Here you are with.
Well, I was representing our dad.
Yes. Okay.
This was June of 2001.
Uh-huh.
It was kind of neat. The people on the, starting from left to right, yes. Clay Matthews.
Oh.
Louis Tiant. Joe Tate, Jimmy Sutphin, Reggie Rucker. Mike Pruitt and Clark Kellogg.
Wow.
And I wore a red bow tie in honor of our dad.
That is nice. You've got such great memorabilia. Jim, thanks for joining us. And I'm sure that our viewers and listeners who dial into the Cleveland Public Library website certainly have enjoyed this conversation. Thanks for doing it.
Thank you very much.